In precisely those years when civil rights legislation coming out of Congress reached its peak, 1964 and 1965, there were black outbreaks in every part of the country. In Florida, set off by the killing of a Negro woman and a bomb threat against a Negro high school. In Cleveland, set off by the killing of a white minister who sat in the path of a bulldozer to protest discrimination against blacks in construction work. In New York, set off by the fatal shooting of a 15-year-old Negro boy during a fight with an off-duty policeman. There were riots also in Rochester, Jersey City, Chicago, Philadelphia. In August 1965, just as Lyndon Johnson was signing into law the Strong Voting Rights Act, providing for federal registration of black voters to ensure their protection, the black ghetto in Watts, Los Angeles, erupted in the most violent urban outbreak since World War II. It was provoked by the forcible arrest of a young Negro driver, the clubbing of a bystander by police, the seizure of a young black woman falsely accused of spitting on the police. There was rioting in the streets, looting and firebombing of stores. Police and National Guardsmen were called in. They used their guns. 34 people were killed, most of them black. Hundreds injured, 4,000 arrested. Robert Cannot, a West Coast journalist, wrote of the riot, "Rivers of Blood, Years of Darkness." In Los Angeles, the Negro was going on record that he would no longer turn the other cheek. That, frustrated and goaded, he would strike back, whether the response of violence was an appropriate one or no. In the summer of 1966, there were more outbreaks with rock throwing, looting, and firebombing by Chicago blacks and wild shootings by the National Guard. Three blacks were killed, one a 13-year-old boy, another a 14-year-old pregnant girl. In Cleveland, the National Guard was summoned to stop a commotion in the black community. Four Negroes were shot to death, two by troopers, two by white civilians. It seemed clear by now that the nonviolence of the Southern movement, perhaps tactically necessary in the Southern atmosphere, and effective because it could be used to appeal to national opinion against the segregationist South, was not enough to deal with the entrenched problems of poverty in the black ghetto. In 1910, 90% of Negroes lived in the South. But by 1965, mechanical cotton pickers harvested 81% of Mississippi Delta cotton. Between 1940 and 1970, 4 million blacks left the country for the city. By 1965, 80% of blacks lived in cities, and 50% of the black people lived in the North. There was a new mood in SNCC and among many militant blacks. Their disillusionment was expressed by a young black writer, Julius Lester. "Now it is over. America has had chance after chance to show that it really meant that all men are endowed with certain inalienable rights. Now it is over. The days of singing freedom songs and the days of combating bullets and billy clubs with love. Love is fragile and gentle and seeks a like response. They used to sing, 'I love everybody,' as they ducked bricks and bottles. Now they sing, 'Too much love, too much love. Nothing kills a nigger like too much love.'" In 1967, in the black ghettos of the country, came the greatest urban riots of American history. According to the report of the National Advisory Committee on Urban Disorders, they involved Negroes acting against local symbols of white American society, symbols of authority and property in the black neighborhoods, rather than purely against white persons. The commission reported 8 major uprisings, 33 serious but not major outbreaks, and 123 minor disorders. 83 died of gunfire, mostly in Newark and Detroit. The overwhelming majority of the persons killed or injured in all the disorders were Negro civilians. The typical rioter, according to the commission, was a young high school dropout, but nevertheless somewhat better educated than his non-rioting Negro neighbor, and usually underemployed or employed in a menial job. He was proud of his race, extremely hostile to both whites and middle-class Negroes, and although informed about politics, highly distrustful of the political system. The report blamed white racism for the disorders and identified the ingredients of the explosive mixture which has been accumulating in our cities since the end of World War II. Pervasive discrimination and segregation in employment, education, and housing. Growing concentrations of impoverished Negroes in our major cities, creating a growing crisis of deteriorating facilities and services and unmet human needs. A new mood has sprung up among Negroes, particularly the young, in which self-esteem and enhanced racial pride are replacing apathy and submission to the system. But the commission report itself was a standard device of the system when facing rebellion. Set up an investigating committee, issue a report. The words of the report, however strong, will have a soothing effect. That didn't completely work either. Black power was the new slogan, an expression of distrust of any progress given or conceded by whites, a rejection of paternalism. Few blacks, or whites, knew the statement of the white writer Aldous Huxley. Liberties are not given, they are taken. But the idea was there, in black power. Also a pride in race, an insistence on black independence, and often on black separation to achieve this independence. Malcolm X was the most eloquent spokesman for this. After he was assassinated, as he spoke on a platform in February 1965, in a plan whose origins are still obscure, he became the martyr of this movement. Hundreds of thousands read his autobiography. He was more influential in death than during his lifetime. Martin Luther King, though still respected, was being replaced now by new heroes. Huey Newton of the Black Panthers, for instance. The Panthers had guns. They said blacks should defend themselves. Malcolm X, in late 1964, had spoken to black students from Mississippi visiting Harlem. You'll get freedom by letting your enemy know that you'll do anything to get your freedom. Then you'll get it. It's the only way you'll get it. When you get that kind of attitude, they'll label you as a crazy Negro, or they'll call you a crazy nigger. They don't say Negro. Or they'll call you an extremist, or a subversive, or seditious, or a red, or a radical. But when you stay radical long enough and get enough people to be like you, you'll get your freedom. Congress responded to the riots of 1967 by passing the Civil Rights Act of 1968. Presumably, it would make stronger the laws prohibiting violence against blacks. It increased the penalties against those depriving people of their civil rights. However, it said, "The provisions of this section shall not apply to acts or omissions on the part of law enforcement officers, members of the National Guard, or members of the armed forces of the United States who are engaged in suppressing a riot or civil disturbance." Furthermore, it added a section, agreed to by liberal members of Congress in order to get the whole bill passed, that provided up to 5 years in prison for anyone traveling interstate or using interstate facilities, including mail and telephone, to organize, promote, encourage, participate in, or carry on a riot. It defined a riot as an action by three or more people involving threats of violence. The first person prosecuted under the Civil Rights Act of 1968 was a young black leader of SNCC, H. Rapp Brown, who had made a militant, angry speech in Maryland just before a racial disturbance there. Later, the act would be used against anti-war demonstrators in Chicago, the Chicago Eight. Martin Luther King himself became more and more concerned about problems untouched by civil rights laws, problems coming out of poverty. In the spring of 1968, he began speaking out against the advice of some Negro leaders who feared losing friends in Washington, against the war in Vietnam. He connected war and poverty. It's inevitable that we've got to bring out the question of the tragic mix-up in priorities. We are spending all of this money for death and destruction, and not nearly enough money for life and constructive development. When the guns of war become a national obsession, social needs inevitably suffer. King now became a chief target of the FBI, which tapped his private phone conversations, sent him fake letters, threatened him, blackmailed him, and even suggested once in an anonymous letter that he commit suicide. FBI internal memos discussed finding a black leader to replace King. As a Senate report on the FBI said in 1976, the FBI tried to destroy Dr. Martin Luther King. King was turning his attention to troublesome questions. He still insisted on nonviolence. Riots were self-defeating, he thought. But they did express a deep feeling that could not be ignored. And so nonviolence, he said, must be militant, massive nonviolence. He planned a poor people's encampment in Washington, this time not with the paternal approval of the president. And he went to Memphis, Tennessee, to support a strike of garbage workers in that city. There, standing on a balcony outside his hotel room, he was shot to death by an unseen marksman. The poor people's encampment went on, and then it was broken up by police action, just as the World War I Veterans Bonus Army of 1932 was dispersed. The killing of King brought new urban outbreaks all over the country, in which 39 people were killed, 35 of them black. Evidence was piling up that even with all of the civil rights laws now on the books, the courts would not protect blacks against violence and injustice. 1. In the 1967 riots in Detroit, 3 black teenagers were killed in the Algiers Motel. 3 Detroit policemen and a black private guard were tried for this triple murder. The defense conceded, a UPI dispatch said, that the 4 men had shot 2 of the blacks. A jury exonerated them. 2. In Jackson, Mississippi, in the spring of 1970, on the campus of Jackson State College, a Negro college, police laid down a 28-second barrage of gunfire using shotguns, rifles, and a submachine gun. 400 bullets or pieces of buckshot struck the girls' dormitory and 2 black students were killed. A local grand jury found the attack justified, and U.S. District Court Judge Harold Cox, a Kennedy appointee, declared that students who engage in civil disorders must expect to be injured or killed. 3. In Boston in April 1970, a policeman shot and killed an unarmed black man, a patient in a ward in the Boston City Hospital, firing 5 shots after the black man snapped a towel at him. The chief judge of the Municipal Court of Boston exonerated the policeman. 4. In Augusta, Georgia, in May 1970, 6 Negroes were shot to death during looting and disorder in the city. The New York Times reported, "A confidential police report indicates that at least 5 of the victims were killed by the police. An eyewitness to one of the deaths said he had watched a Negro policeman and his white partner fire 9 shots into the back of a man suspected of looting. They did not fire warning shots or ask him to stop running," said Charles A. Reed, a 38-year-old businessman. 5. In April 1970, a federal jury in Boston found a policeman had used excessive force against 2 black soldiers from Fort Devens, and one of them required 12 stitches in his scalp. The judge awarded the serviceman $3 in damages. These were normal cases, endlessly repeated in the history of the country, coming randomly but persistently out of a racism deep in the institutions, the mind of the country. But there was something else, a planned pattern of violence against militant black organizers, carried on by the police and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. On December 4th, 1969, a little before 5 in the morning, a squad of Chicago police, armed with a submachine gun and shotguns, raided an apartment where Black Panthers lived. They fired at least 82 and perhaps 200 rounds into the apartment, killing 21-year-old Black Panther leader Fred Hampton as he lay in his bed, and another Black Panther, Mark Clark. Years later, it was discovered in a court proceeding that the FBI had an informer among the Panthers, and that they had given the police a floor plan of the apartment, including a sketch of where Fred Hampton slept. Was the government turning to murder and terror because the concessions, the legislation, the speeches, the intonation of the civil rights hymn "We Shall Overcome" by President Lyndon Johnson, were not working? It was discovered later that the government, in all the years of the civil rights movement, while making concessions through Congress, was acting through the FBI to harass and break up black militant groups. Between 1956 and 1971, the FBI concluded a massive counterintelligence program, known as COINTELPRO, that took 295 actions against black groups. Black militancy seemed stubbornly resistant to destruction. A secret FBI report to President Nixon in 1970 said, "A recent poll indicates that approximately 25% of the black population has a great respect for the Black Panther Party, including 43% of blacks under 21 years of age." Was there fear that blacks would turn their attention from the controllable field of voting to the more dangerous arena of wealth and poverty, of class conflict? In 1966, 70 poor black people in Greenville, Mississippi, occupied an unused Air Force barracks until they were evicted by the military. A local woman, Mrs. Unita Blackwell, said, "I feel that the federal government have proven that it don't care about poor people. Everything that we have asked for through these years had been handed down on paper. It's never been a reality. We, the poor people of Mississippi, is tired. We're tired of it, so we're going to build for ourselves because we don't have a government that represents us." Out of the 1967 riots in Detroit came an organization devoted to organizing black workers for revolutionary change. This was the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which lasted until 1971 and influenced thousands of black workers in Detroit during its period of activity. The new emphasis was more dangerous than civil rights because it created the possibility of blacks and whites uniting on the issue of class exploitation. Back in November 1963, A. Philip Randolph had spoken to an AFL-CIO convention about the civil rights movement and foreseen its direction. "The Negro's protest today is but the first rumbling of the underclass. As the Negro has taken to the streets, so will the unemployed of all races take to the streets." Attempts began to do with blacks what had been done historically with whites, to lure a small number into the system with economic enticements. There was talk of black capitalism. Leaders of the NAACP and CORE were invited to the White House. James Farmer of CORE, a former freedom rider and militant, was given a job in President Nixon's administration. Floyd McKissick of CORE received a $14 million government loan to build a housing development in North Carolina. Lyndon Johnson had given jobs to some blacks through the Office of Economic Opportunity. Nixon set up an Office of Minority Business Enterprise. Chase Manhattan Bank and the Rockefeller family, controllers of Chase, took a special interest in developing black capitalism. The Rockefellers had always been financial patrons of the Urban League and a strong influence in black education through their support of Negro colleges in the South. David Rockefeller tried to persuade his fellow capitalists that while helping black businessmen with money might not be fruitful in the short run, it was necessary to shape an environment in which the business can continue earning a profit 4 or 5 or 10 years from now. With all of this, black business remained infinitesimally small. The largest black corporation, Motown Industries, had sales in 1974 of $45 million, while Exxon Corporation had sales of $42 billion. The total receipts of black-owned firms accounted for 0.3% of all business income. There was a small amount of change and a lot of publicity. There were more black faces in the newspapers and on television, creating an impression of change, and siphoning off into the mainstream a small but significant number of black leaders. Some new black voices spoke against this. Robert Allen, Black Awakening in Capitalist America, wrote, "If the community as a whole is to benefit, then the community as a whole must be organized to manage collectively its internal economy and its business relations with white America. Black business firms must be treated and operated as social property belonging to the general black community, not as the private property of individual or limited groups of individuals. This necessitates the dismantling of capitalist property relations in the black community and their replacement with a planned communal economy." A black woman, Patricia Robinson, in a pamphlet distributed in Boston in 1970 entitled Poor Black Woman, tied male supremacy to capitalism and said the black woman allies herself with the have-nots in the wider world and their revolutionary struggles. She said the poor black woman did not in the past question the social and economic system, but now she must, and in fact, she has begun to question aggressive male domination and the class society which enforces it, capitalism. Another black woman, Margaret Wright, said she was not fighting for equality with men if it meant equality in the world of killing, the world of competition. I don't want to compete on no damned exploitative level. I don't want to exploit nobody. I want the right to be black and me. The system was working hard, by the late 60s and early 70s, to contain the frightening explosiveness of the black upsurge. Blacks were voting in large numbers in the South, and in the 1968 Democratic Convention, three blacks were admitted into the Mississippi delegation. By 1977, more than 2,000 blacks held office in 11 southern states. In 1965, the number was 72. There were 2 congressmen, 11 state senators, 95 state representatives, 267 county commissioners, 76 mayors, 824 city council members, 18 sheriffs or chiefs of police, 508 school board members. It was a dramatic advance. But blacks, with 20% of the South's population, still held less than 3% of the elective offices. A New York Times reporter, analyzing the new situation in 1977, pointed out that even where blacks held important city offices, whites almost always retain economic power. After Maynard Jackson, a black, became mayor of Atlanta, the white business establishment continued to exert its influence. Those blacks in the South who could afford to go to downtown restaurants and hotels were no longer barred because of their race. More blacks could go to colleges and universities, to law schools and medical schools. Northern cities were busing children back and forth in an attempt to create racially mixed schools, despite the racial segregation in housing. None of this, however, was halting what Francis Piven and Richard Cloward, in Poor People's Movements, called the destruction of the black lower class, the unemployment, the deterioration of the ghetto, the rise in crime, drug addiction, violence. In the summer of 1977, the Department of Labor reported that the rate of unemployment among black youths was 34.8%. A small new black middle class had been created, and it raised the overall statistics for black income, but there was a great disparity between the newly risen middle class black and the poor left behind. Despite the new opportunities for a small number of blacks, the median black family income of 1977 was only about 60% that of whites. Blacks were twice as likely to die of diabetes, 7 times as likely to be victims of homicidal violence rising out of the poverty and despair of the ghetto. A New York Times report in early 1978 said, "The places that have experienced urban riots in the 1960s have, with a few exceptions, changed little, and the conditions of poverty have spread in most cities." Statistics did not tell the whole story. Racism, always a national fact, not just a southern one, emerged in northern cities. As the federal government made concessions to poor blacks in a way that pitted them against poor whites for resources made scarce by the system. Blacks, freed from slavery to take their place under capitalism, had long been forced into conflict with whites for scarce jobs. Now, with desegregation and housing, blacks had to move into neighborhoods where whites, themselves poor, crowded, troubled, could find in them a target for their anger. In the Boston Globe, November 1977. A Hispanic family of 6 fled their apartment in the Savin Hill section of Dorchester yesterday after a week of repeated stonings and window smashings by a group of white youths in what appears to have been racially motivated attacks, police said. In Boston, the busing of black children to white schools and whites to black schools set off a wave of white neighborhood violence. The use of busing to integrate schools, sponsored by the government and the courts in response to the black movement, was an ingenious concession to protest. It had the effect of pushing poor whites and poor blacks into competition for the miserable and inadequate schools which the system provided for all the poor. Was the black population hemmed into the ghetto divided by the growth of a middle class, decimated by poverty, attacked by the government, driven into conflict with whites, under control? Surely in the mid-70s, there was no great black movement underway. Yet a new black consciousness had been born and was still alive. Also, whites and blacks were crossing racial lines in the South to unite as a class against employers. In 1971, 2,000 woodworkers in Mississippi, black and white, joined together to protest a new method of measuring wood that led to lower wages. In the textile mills of J.P. Stevens, where 44,000 workers were employed in 85 plants, mostly in the South, blacks and whites were working together in union activity. In Tifton, Georgia, and Milledgeville, Georgia, in 1977, blacks and whites served together on the union committees of their plants. Would a new black movement go beyond the limits of the civil rights actions of the 60s, beyond the spontaneous urban riots of the 70s, beyond separatism to a coalition of white and black in a historic new alliance? There was no way of knowing this in 1978. In 1978, 6 million black people were unemployed. As Langston Hughes said, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up, or does it explode? If it did explode, as it had in the past, it would come with a certain inevitability out of the conditions of black life in America. And yet, because no one knew when, it would come as a surprise. From 1964 to 1972, the wealthiest and most powerful nation in the history of the world made a maximum military effort, with everything short of atomic bombs, to defeat a nationalist revolutionary movement in a tiny peasant country, and failed. When the United States fought in Vietnam, it was organized modern technology versus organized human beings, and the human beings won. In the course of that war, there developed in the United States the greatest anti-war movement the nation had ever experienced, a movement that played a critical part in bringing the war to an end. It was another startling fact of the 60s. In the fall of 1945, Japan, defeated, was forced to leave Indochina, the former French colony it had occupied at the start of the war. In the meantime, a revolutionary movement had grown there, determined to end colonial control and to achieve a new life for the peasants of Indochina. Led by a communist named Ho Chi Minh, the revolutionists fought against the Japanese, and when they were gone, held a spectacular celebration in Hanoi in late 1945, with 1 million people in the streets, and issued a Declaration of Independence. It borrowed from the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen in the French Revolution, and from the American Declaration of Independence, and began, "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Just as the Americans in 1776 had listed their grievances against the English king, the Vietnamese listed their complaints against French rule. "They have enforced inhuman laws. They have built more prisons than schools. They have mercilessly slain our patriots. They have drowned uprisings in rivers of blood. They have fettered public opinion. They have robbed us of our rice fields, our mines, our forests, and our raw materials. They have invented numerous unjustifiable taxes and reduced our people, especially our peasantry, to a state of extreme poverty. From the end of last year to the beginning of this year, more than 2 million of our fellow citizens died of starvation. The whole Vietnamese people, animated by a common purpose, are determined to fight to the bitter end against any attempt by the French colonialists to reconquer their country." The U.S. Defense Department study of the Vietnam War, intended to be top secret, but released to the public by Daniel Ellsberg and Anthony Russo in the famous Pentagon Papers case, described Ho Chi Minh's work. Ho had built the Viet Minh into the only Vietnam-wide political organization capable of effective resistance to either the Japanese or the French. He was the only Vietnamese wartime leader with a national following, and he assured himself wider fealty among the Vietnamese people when in August-September 1945 he overthrew the Japanese, established the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, and staged receptions for incoming Allied occupation forces. For a few weeks in September 1945, Vietnam was, for the first and only time in its modern history, free of foreign domination and united from north to south under Ho Chi Minh. The Western powers were already at work to change this. England occupied the southern part of Indochina and then turned it back to the French. Nationalist China, this was under Chiang Kai-shek, before the Communist Revolution, occupied the northern part of Indochina, and the United States persuaded it to turn that back to the French. As Ho Chi Minh told an American journalist, "We apparently stand quite alone. We shall have to depend on ourselves." Between October 1945 and February 1946, Ho Chi Minh wrote 8 letters to President Truman, reminding him of the self-determination promises of the Atlantic Charter. One of the letters was sent both to Truman and to the United Nations. "I wish to invite attention of Your Excellency for strictly humanitarian reasons to following matter. 2 million Vietnamese died of starvation during winter of 1944 and spring 1945 because of starvation policy of French, who seized and stored until it rotted all available rice. 3/4 of cultivated land was flooded in summer 1945, which was followed by a severe drought. Of normal harvest, 5/6 was lost. Many people are starving. Unless great world powers and international relief organizations bring us immediate assistance, we face imminent catastrophe." Truman never replied. In October of 1946, the French bombarded Haiphong, a port in northern Vietnam, and there began the 8-year war between the Viet Minh movement and the French over who would rule Vietnam. After the communist victory in China in 1949 and the Korean War the following year, the United States began giving large amounts of military aid to the French. By 1954, the United States had given 300,000 small arms and machine guns, enough to equip the entire French army in Indochina, and $1 billion. Altogether, the U.S. was financing 80% of the French war effort. Why was the United States doing this? To the public, the word was that the United States was helping to stop communism in Asia, but there was not much public discussion. In the secret memoranda of the National Security Council, which advised the president on foreign policy, there was talk in 1950 of what came to be known as the domino theory, that, like a row of dominoes, if one country fell to communism, the next one would do the same, and so on. It was important, therefore, to keep the first one from falling. A secret memo of the National Security Council in June 1952 also pointed to the chain of U.S. military bases along the coast of China, the Philippines, Taiwan, Japan, South Korea. Communist control of all Southeast Asia would render the U.S. position in the Pacific offshore island chain precarious and would seriously jeopardize fundamental U.S. security interests in the Far East. And Southeast Asia, especially Malaya and Indonesia, is the principal world source of natural rubber and tin and a producer of petroleum and other strategically important commodities. It was also noted that Japan depended on the rice of Southeast Asia, and communist victory there would make it extremely difficult to prevent Japan's eventual accommodation to communism. In 1953, a congressional study mission reported, "The area of Indochina is immensely wealthy in rice, rubber, coal, and iron ore. Its position makes it a strategic key to the rest of Southeast Asia." That year, a State Department memorandum said that the French were losing the war in Indochina, had failed to win a sufficient native support, feared that a negotiated settlement would mean the eventual loss to communism not only of Indochina, but of the whole of Southeast Asia, and concluded, "If the French actually decided to withdraw, the U.S. would have to consider most seriously whether to take over in this area." In 1954, the French, having been unable to win Vietnamese popular support, which was overwhelmingly behind Ho Chi Minh and the revolutionary movement, had to withdraw. An international assemblage at Geneva presided over the peace agreement between the French and the Viet Minh. It was agreed that the French would temporarily withdraw into the southern part of Vietnam, that the Viet Minh would remain in the north, and that an election would take place in 2 years in a unified Vietnam to enable the Vietnamese to choose their own government. The United States moved quickly to prevent the unification and to establish South Vietnam as an American sphere. It set up in Saigon as head of the government a former Vietnamese official named Ngo Dinh Diem, who had recently been living in New Jersey, and encouraged him not to hold the scheduled elections for unification. A memo in early 1954 of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said that intelligence estimates showed a settlement based on free elections would be attended by almost certain loss of the associated states, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, the three parts of Indochina created by the Geneva Conference, to communist control. Diem again and again blocked the elections requested by the Viet Minh, and with American money and arms, his government became more and more firmly established. As the Pentagon Papers put it, South Vietnam was essentially the creation of the United States. The Diem regime became increasingly unpopular. Diem was a Catholic, and most Vietnamese were Buddhists. Diem was close to the landlords, and this was a country of peasants. His pretenses at land reform left things basically as they were. He replaced locally selected provincial chiefs with his own men, appointed in Saigon. By 1962, 88% of these provincial chiefs were military men. Diem imprisoned more and more Vietnamese who criticized the regime for corruption, for lack of reform. Opposition grew quickly in the countryside, where Diem's apparatus could not reach well, and around 1958, guerrilla activities began against the regime. The communist regime in Hanoi gave aid, encouragement, and sent people south, most of them southerners who had gone north after the Geneva Accords, to support the guerrilla movement. In 1960, the National Liberation Front was formed in the south. It united the various strands of opposition to the regime. Its strength came from South Vietnamese peasants, who saw it as a way of changing their daily lives. A U.S. government analyst named Douglas Pike, in his book Viet Cong, based on interviews with rebels and captured documents, tried to give a realistic assessment of what the United States faced. In the 2,561 villages of South Vietnam, the National Liberation Front created a host of nationwide socio-political organizations in a country where mass organizations were virtually non-existent. Aside from the NLF, there had never been a truly mass-based political party in South Vietnam. Pike wrote, "The communists have brought to the villages of South Vietnam significant social change, and have done so largely by means of the communication process. That is, they were organizers much more than they were warriors. What struck me most forcibly about the NLF was its totality as a social revolution first, and as a war second." Pike was impressed with the mass involvement of the peasants in the movement. The rural Vietnamese was not regarded simply as a pawn in a power struggle, but as the active element in the thrust. He was the thrust. Pike wrote, "The purpose of this vast organizational effort was to restructure the social order of the village and train the villages to control themselves. This was the NLF's one undeviating thrust from the start. Not the killing of Arvin, Saigon soldiers, not the occupation of real estate, not the preparation of some great pitched battle, but organization in depth of the rural population through the instrument of self-control." Pike estimated that the NLF membership by early 1962 stood at around 300,000. The Pentagon Papers said of this period, "Only the Viet Cong had any real support and influence on a broad base in the countryside." When Kennedy took office in early 1961, he continued the policies of Truman and Eisenhower in Southeast Asia. Almost immediately, he approved a secret plan for various military actions in Vietnam and Laos, including the dispatch of agents to North Vietnam to engage in sabotage and light harassment, according to the Pentagon Papers. Back in 1956, he had spoken of the amazing success of President Diem and said of Diem's Vietnam, "Her political liberty is an inspiration." One day in June 1963, a Buddhist monk sat down in the public square in Saigon and set himself afire. More Buddhist monks began committing suicide by fire to dramatize their opposition to the Diem regime. Diem's police raided the Buddhist pagodas and temples, wounded 30 monks, arrested 1,400 people, and closed down the pagodas. There were demonstrations in the city. The police fired, killing 9 people. Then, in Wei, the ancient capital, 10,000 demonstrated in protest. Under the Geneva Accords, the United States was permitted to have 685 military advisors in southern Vietnam. Eisenhower secretly sent several thousand. Under Kennedy, the figure rose to 16,000, and some of them began to take part in combat operations. Diem was losing. Most of the South Vietnam countryside was now controlled by local villagers, organized by the NLF. Diem was becoming an embarrassment, an obstacle to effective control over Vietnam. Some Vietnamese generals began plotting to overthrow his regime, staying in touch with a CIA man named Lucien Conan. Conan met secretly with American Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, who was enthusiastically for the coup. Lodge reported to Kennedy's assistant, McGeorge Bundy, on October 25th, Pentagon Papers. "I have personally approved each meeting between General Tran Van Don and Conan, who has carried out my orders in each instance explicitly." Kennedy seemed hesitant, but no move was made to warn Diem. Indeed, just before the coup, and just after he had been in touch through Conan with the plotters, Lodge spent a weekend with Diem at a seaside resort. When on November 1, 1963, the generals attacked the presidential palace, Diem phoned Ambassador Lodge, and the conversation went as follows. "Diem, some units have made a rebellion, and I want to know what is the attitude of the United States." Lodge, "I do not feel well enough informed to be able to tell you. I have heard the shooting, but am not acquainted with all of the facts. Also, it is 4:30 a.m. in Washington, and the U.S. government cannot possibly have a view." Diem, "But you must have some general ideas." Lodge told Diem to phone him if he could do anything for his physical safety. That was the last conversation any American had with Diem. He fled the palace, but he and his brother were apprehended by the plotters, taken out in a truck, and executed. Earlier in 1963, Kennedy's Undersecretary of State, U. Alexis Johnson, was speaking before the Economic Club of Detroit. "What is the attraction that Southeast Asia has exerted for centuries on the great powers flanking it on all sides? Why is it desirable, and why is it important? First, it provides a lush climate, fertile soil, rich natural resources, a relatively sparse population in most areas, and room to expand. The countries of Southeast Asia produce rich exportable surpluses such as rice, rubber, teak, corn, tin, spices, oil, and many others." This is not the language that was used by President Kennedy in his explanations to the American public. He talked of communism and freedom. In a news conference, February 14, 1962, he said, "Yes, as you know, the U.S., for more than a decade, has been assisting the government, the people of Vietnam, to maintain their independence." 3 weeks after the execution of Diem, Kennedy himself was assassinated, and his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, took office. The generals who succeeded Diem could not suppress the National Liberation Front. Again and again, American leaders expressed their bewilderment at the popularity of the NLF, at the high morale of its soldiers. The Pentagon historians wrote that when Eisenhower met with President-elect Kennedy in January 1961, he wondered aloud why, in interventions of this kind, we always seem to find that the morale of the communist forces was better than that of the democratic forces. And General Maxwell Taylor reported in late 1964, "The ability of the Viet Cong continuously to rebuild their units and to make good their losses is one of the mysteries of the guerrilla war. Not only do the Viet Cong units have the recuperative powers of the Phoenix, but they have an amazing ability to maintain morale. Only in rare cases have we found evidences of bad morale among Viet Cong prisoners or recorded in captured Viet Cong documents." In early August 1964, President Johnson used a murky set of events in the Gulf of Tonkin off the coast of North Vietnam to launch full-scale war on Vietnam. Johnson and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara told the American public there was an attack by North Vietnamese torpedo boats on American destroyers. While on routine patrol in international waters, McNamara said, the U.S. destroyer Maddox underwent an unprovoked attack. It later turned out that the Gulf of Tonkin episode was a fake, that the highest American officials had lied to the public, just as they had in the invasion of Cuba under Kennedy. In fact, the CIA had engaged in a secret operation attacking North Vietnamese coastal installations, so if there had been an attack, it would not have been unprovoked. It was not a routine patrol because the Maddox was on a special electronic spying mission, and it was not in international waters, but in Vietnamese territorial waters. It turned out that no torpedoes were fired at the Maddox, as McNamara said. Another reported attack on another destroyer two nights later, which Johnson called open aggression on the high seas, seems also to have been an invention. At the time of the incident, Secretary of State Rusk was questioned on NBC television. Reporter, what explanation, then, can you come up with for this unprovoked attack? Rusk, well, I haven't been able, quite frankly, to come to a fully satisfactory explanation. There is a great gulf of understanding between that world and our world, ideological in character. They see what we think of as the real world in wholly different terms. Their very processes of logic are different, so that it's very difficult to enter into each other's minds across that great ideological gulf. The Tonkin attack brought a congressional resolution, passed unanimously in the House, and with only two dissenting votes in the Senate, giving Johnson the power to take military action as he saw fit in Southeast Asia. 2 months before the Gulf of Tonkin incident, U.S. government leaders met in Honolulu and discussed such a resolution. Rusk said in this meeting, according to the Pentagon Papers, that public opinion on our Southeast Asia policy was badly divided in the United States at that moment, and that, therefore, the president needed an affirmation of support. The Tonkin resolution gave the president the power to initiate hostilities without the declaration of war by Congress that the Constitution required. The Supreme Court, supposed to be the watchdog of the Constitution, was asked by a number of petitioners in the course of the Vietnam War to declare the war unconstitutional. Again and again, it refused even to consider the issue. Immediately after the Tonkin affair, American warplanes began bombarding North Vietnam. During 1965, over 200,000 American soldiers were sent to South Vietnam, and in 1966, 200,000 more. By early 1968, there were more than 500,000 American troops there, and the U.S. Air Force was dropping bombs at a rate unequaled in history. Tiny glimmerings of the massive human suffering under this bombardment came to the outside world. On June 5, 1965, the New York Times carried a dispatch from Saigon. As the communists withdrew from Wangai last Monday, United States jet bombers pounded the hills into which they were headed. Many Vietnamese, one estimate is as high as 500, were killed by the strikes. The American contention is that they were Viet Cong soldiers, but 3 out of 4 patients seeking treatment in a Vietnamese hospital afterward for burns from napalm or jelly gasoline were village women. On September 6th, another press dispatch from Saigon. In Benoit Province, south of Saigon, on August 15th, United States aircraft accidentally bombed a Buddhist pagoda and a Catholic church. It was the third time their pagoda had been bombed in 1965. A temple of the Cao Dai religious sect in the same area had been bombed twice this year. In another Delta province, there is a woman who has both arms burned off by napalm and her eyelids so badly burned that she cannot close them. When it is time for her to sleep, her family puts a blanket over her head. The woman had 2 of her children killed in the airstrike that maimed her. Few Americans appreciate what their nation is doing to South Vietnam with air power. Innocent civilians are dying every day in South Vietnam. Large areas of South Vietnam were declared free fire zones, which meant that all persons remaining within them, civilians, old people, children, were considered an enemy, and bombs were dropped at will. Villages suspected of harboring Viet Cong were subject to search and destroy missions. Men of military age in the villages were killed, the homes were burned, the women, children, and old people were sent off to refugee camps. Jonathan Schell, in his book The Village of Ben Suk, describes such an operation. A village surrounded, attacked, a man riding on a bicycle shot down, three people picnicking by the river shot to death, the houses destroyed, the women, children, old people herded together, taken away from their ancestral homes. The CIA in Vietnam, in a program called Operation Phoenix, secretly, without trial, executed at least 20,000 civilians in South Vietnam who were suspected of being members of the communist underground. A pro-administration analyst wrote in the journal Foreign Affairs in January 1975, "Although the Phoenix program did undoubtedly kill or incarcerate many innocent civilians, it did also eliminate many members of the communist infrastructure."